doesn't mean Canada's done, but this is just going to be the process to get in and refederate this thing.
Welcome to the show that the fact-checkers warned you about. The one that debunks the mainstream narrative and gives you high-signal, actionable content that helps you navigate the clown world. It's Bomb Thrower TV with your host, Mark Jeftovic.
Hey, it's Mark Jeftovic here. I want to give you a quick shout out to Ready.ca. This is going to be a Canadian grassroots network for preparation, readiness, and helping each other out in a time when our leaders and our institutions are clearly out of their depth. So head on over to Ready.ca, pop in your email. We are still making this up as we go along, but I will be sending out details on how we can all work together through this fourth turning era. See you there. Hey, everybody. Mark Jeftovic here with another episode of Bomb Thrower TV. Long overdue. Very happy to have Corey Morgan on the show today from Alberta. He's the author of The Sovereigntist's Handbook. Oh, my God. The subtitle escapes me. It is Mapping a Pathway to Alberta Independence, right?
I believe so. Or was it Charting?
I've got Charting. It's Charting. Yeah.
I believe it's Charting. I didn't bring a copy.
Yeah. I know. And so like my copy's on Kindle, so I don't have the physical one, but I'll edit in a cover. And of course, we'll link to it in the show notes. We met because we did the audio book for your book when it first came out. And at the time we thought, you know, there will be a time in the future when this topic is more front of mind. And I can't think of a time where it's more front of mind than right now in the federal election run to, one of the most, I don't know how to describe this election cycle. We come from two completely separate parts of the country, but I think we're on the same page in a lot of aspects of this. And, let's just start with your background. You're born and raised in Alberta, right?
I am, yeah. Born in Red Deer, raised in Banff, and live just outside of Calgary now.
Yeah, nice. And you were pretty early in politics. You were involved in the Reform Party back in the day. Were you a founder of the Alberta Party or the Alberta Independence Party?
Yes, it's kind of a convoluted story. So there was an Alberta Party, it was called. It was a provincial party. It was registered. It was actually formed by one of Alberta's first elected senators. And I got frustrated with that, being young and hyper and an alienated Westerner, and myself and some others broke off from that and formed the Alberta Independence Party about 1999, and which was, an independence-minded party wanting to go further. Ralph Klein was in power. Jean Chrétien was the prime minister. And we felt it's time to make that full-out push for independence as the battles look so similar to where they are today. It's just so little changes.
Yeah, and one of the things you wrote in the book, a quote I pulled out, is Canada's entire political system is imbalanced. It's designed to treat the outlying provinces as resource producers to be plundered for the benefit of the center of the country. Provinces beyond Ontario and Quebec are not considered partners within Confederation so much as vassal states beholden to Ottawa.
Yeah, I get pretty colorful in the writing, but there's truth to it. And part of what I cover in the book, too, is it's not a matter of being, personal or knocking the people of Quebec and Ontario necessarily. It's the system. That's pointing out the system that made sense perhaps in 1867. But now that we've got such diversity across this country and different population balance and different industrial development, this system is really serving the outlying provinces very poorly. And it seems to be impossible to change it from within.
Yeah, one of the statistics I picked up from the book is, this system was designed when 4% of the country's population lived in Alberta. And now it's, what is it now, 30, 35?
It's not that high. I believe Alberta is making up about 12 or 13%, but we make up about 15 or 16% of the GDP. so that there's part of that imbalance that's going on in a sense as well. It's a prosperous province.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of that is the oil and gas fields.
Yes, and then actually, yeah, with that stat we're talking about, when you bring in Saskatchewan and British Columbia that are alienated, then you're getting into that larger amount of the population that's
Right.
still very underrepresented when it comes to political representation and ability.
And you know what's strange now is so much of the prosperity of the Western provinces is generated from oil and gas, and of course there's the you know the breadbasket of the world as well. But this hostility towards fossil fuels from this last Liberal government, and I don't know how that's going to continue if there's another Liberal government.
Yeah, there's been an ideological anti-oil and gas movement. I mean, Justin Trudeau, that was his legacy. He wanted to be the man who tackled world climate change, and he felt that through shutting down conventional oil and gas industries, essentially, I mean, what was the means to do it? He did so through C-69, which, we'll probably talk a little more about Carney, but that's an anti-pipeline bill that basically regulates it to death, trying to get product to market outside of Alberta. It was a sneaky way to kind of shut down the development out here by not outright banning any of it, just as long as you choke off all the ability to get it to outside markets. You want to go farther back, of course, Pierre Trudeau wasn't so much anti-oil and gas. He just didn't care about it until he saw it as a resource all of a sudden that was valuable to Canada. He was indifferent to it until the price shocks of the 70s. And then he brought in the National Energy Program and made a resource grab that we still haven't forgiven him for. But yeah, Alberta, Saskatchewan, BC, with their energy sector, certainly don't feel loved by Canada and the governments centrally, particularly the Liberal ones.
The Liberals have had a long history of demonizing the Western provinces. Chrétien, you quoted them. I don't like dealing with Westerners, and Trudeau, screw the rest, we'll take the rest.
Yeah.
Did he actually say that, or was that just sort of the sentiment that you coined or encapsulated?
No, that was Trudeau's advisor. I should have my book. It was his name, but I have that on hand. That was one of Trudeau's prime campaign advisors. That's what he outright said. That's Trudeau Senior we're speaking of.
Yes, of course, the elder. Yeah.
And again, it really drives home the core tactical advantage in keeping the West alienated and campaigning towards Central Canada. Whether or not a person wants to take it personally, it doesn't matter. If you want to win and become government candidate, you have to campaign to the center. If you try to campaign to the outlying areas, you're not going to form government. Reform Party figured that out well enough, quite successful in the West, but they couldn't break into the East. So that screw the West, we'll take the rest tactic is still in use today, and you can somewhat see it.
Yeah, I mean, it really, I'm sitting all the way over here in Ontario. I'm like right in the belly of the beast. And when you analyze the dynamics of this country, I think it was Greg Foss, who's like a Bitcoiner, famous Canadian Bitcoiner, described the Canadian electoral process when he was on a US podcast. And he said, the West feels alienated because on election night, the election's already been decided by the time the polling stations even close in the West, in the Western provinces, because it really all happens in Quebec and Ontario.
Yeah, and that's the truth of it, and the nature of our system, even the nature of the time zones makes that happen. It was so clear for folks like me who are a little more gray in the muzzle when the days when we had nothing but legacy media to watch an election. So the elections in the 80s, we weren't allowed to see any coverage of what was happening in the election until the polls closed at West because they didn't want it impacted. So no television, no radio, no nothing. You didn't know unless you phoned somebody in Eastern Canada because they were getting the coverage. So then, 8 o'clock, the polls close out in Alberta. The TV's allowed to show us what happened. And that's where we see, yeah, it's already been declared for such and such party because, of course, all the votes have been counted and in Eastern Canada. So, aside from just the electoral reality and time zone reality, the psychological reality of how that drives it home, you turn on your TV and wait for them just to basically tell you it's
Who
done. Your
won?
votes don't matter any further after
Yeah.
that. That's just who's got a few more seats here or there.
Yeah. And then I was, I actually
broke out the transfer payments, the equalization payments, and so like have the Western provinces ever gotten any?
Alberta received, I think, 90 million. So they received some way back in the 60s when the program first came about. I believe Saskatchewan received a few billion cumulatively over the whole period of the program. And BC, I'm not sure about them offhand. I'd have to look into it. But it's all minuscule when compared to what goes to the Maritimes and Quebec in particular. Ontario at times has been a contributor. Right now, Ontario is a recipient of equalization. And yeah, and that's just one aspect of the transfers where the West doesn't do well. It's the most flagrant one, but we kind of get shortchanged on all of them.
I mean, this just, I'm looking at last year's numbers. So like the Eastern provinces, you have Newfoundland, 218 million, Prince Edward Island, 610 million. Nova Scotia, you get into the billions, 3.2 and 2.8 for Nova Scotia and New Brunswick. Ontario got half a billion last year. Quebec, 13.3 billion.
Yeah.
Like it just leaps off the page. And then Saskatchewan, zero, Alberta, zero, British Columbia, zero. And a lot of that, like, is this just a trope or is it real? Like, this is Alberta and Saskatchewan oil and gas and wheat revenues funneling over here.
Yeah, it's real, and that's what's happening with it. And there's some selective calculations in the formula. That's part of why, for example, Quebec's revenue from hydroelectric production isn't factored in to the formula.
Yeah, I saw a
So,
tweet of that. Yeah,
yeah.
tell a bit more of
So
that.
they've got billions in revenue that comes in that doesn't get applied. Because, I mean, the theory of equalization, which grates on me as a classical liberal, libertarian-minded person anyways, is that we should always be drawing from the wealthy and pouring it into the less wealthy to make sure everybody's got equal services. Well, if you're going to follow that doctrine, which I don't particularly like anyways, I feel we should move the people to the money rather than try to move the money to the people. But if you're going to do it, then you should calculate it equally all the way across the board with all of the sources of revenue before seeing who needs more to command equal services or not. But then Quebec gets exempted on a whole bunch of them. That province should not be qualifying for such a massive transfer like that. But welcome to Canadian politics because boy, oh boy, we always want to keep Quebec happy because what might happen? Well, they might separate. Well, it seems to have been a pretty successful tactic for them.
I mean, Quebec, I've been saying for a long time, Quebec has been the dog wagging, the tail wagging the dog of Canadian politics forever. I'm sure that's not an original insight. And the bogeyman is Quebec separation, but here we have the West, which is practically funding the rest of the country that is experiencing this animosity and this what's the word I'm looking for, disenfranchisement that is talking about separation, and yet that doesn't put some existential dread into the Laurentian elites or the policymakers in Ottawa. Why do you think that is?
It's because the West hasn't put together an effective, well-organized independence movement that's brought it close enough to look like a realistic possibility, which I'm sure will lead to it. It looks like the stars might be lining up where that's going to change pretty quickly, actually. There have been ebbs and flows of support for independence. I mean, in the 80s, the National Energy Program, Western Canada Concept member got elected in Alberta. So, I mean, they were beginning to be electorally viable. But it did calm down through Reform Party. People kind of grasped that thread and said, "Oh no, there's hope. We can change from within." So if there's not a real fear that the province is actually considering enough, they're going to get up and go, then Central Canada doesn't feel any incentive to worry about what Alberta is going to do. And Quebec, on the other hand, they came within a percentage point of going in the 90s. Their movement is very viable and real, and I mean, it might not be as high at the moment, but it's certainly is conceivable that it could reach that tipping point.
So when I'm on a place like Twitter X, what we call it now, and it's obviously we all subscribe to people that we sort of follow. And when I look at it, I see your feed, I see Marty up north, I see these Albertans, and it looks like there is a real impetus, a real momentum here, a real sort of grassroots groundswell for this to happen. Now, how does that compare to like reality on the ground in Alberta? Is Is there this awareness, or are most people kind of oblivious that this is gathering steam or impetus?
It's coming up more. We're seeing Premier Smith addressing it. We saw Preston Manning recently address it in this election. I mean, these are tuned in Albertans who are not even necessarily supportive of the independence movement, but they understand this is becoming real. This is gaining strength. As I kind of say in the book, we look at the alienation, the governments, the policies like waves, when you're at a beach and they come forward and then it goes back and they come forward. But every time that wave comes forward, it actually creates a few more strong, dedicated, independence-minded people, and it's building and it's building. Polls 2 years ago, I believe it was, like before the book was finished, or just after the book was finished, showed support being 24% in Alberta for independence, outright support for independence, not considering but wanting to go. And I was reading the articles on that, and they actually said from Legacy Media, see, there's no real separatist movement in Alberta. There's no independence movement out there. It's only 24 or 25%. Whoa, when you got one in four people saying they want out of Confederation, that's pretty darn serious. That's what would have been considered a fringe viewpoint, and you've got one in four people considering it. Now we've endured 2 more years of a government that we've despised, has really not been friendly to the West. And we've thought, we're kind of leading up to where this is going, thought that, okay, the cycle's going to continue, though. We're going to get a breather. The Canada's ready to move on from the Liberals for a little while. And they went and changed the head of the snake. And it looks like Canada said, you know what? Fine. We're going to give them 4 more years, maybe 10 more years. That 24% is going to expand dramatically if we see another Liberal government. There's no getting around that.
All right. Parenthetically, I'm going to say I call bullshit on all the polls and I call bullshit on the mainstream media. Well, they're paid the bullshit.
Yeah.
So I actually still think we're looking at a CPC blowout. That could be wishful thinking on my part, but let's now park that and just say, okay, we're looking at the polls. It looks like this change the head of the snake gambit is working. I don't know how, but it
Yeah.
is. What has Carney's messaging, has it been at all conciliatory towards the West in any aspect?
Not even slightly. And I mean, if you look at his past writings, he's as much of an ideologue as Justin Trudeau ever was when it comes to the net zero pursuits, the shutting in of conventional oil and gas. The most telling thing recently was when, of course, he was doing all the talk because people did recognize we are very poorly placed in Canada, having essentially only one customer for our oil and gas exports. And we need to get our pipelines to the coast. I mean, that's what we've been screaming here in Alberta for 50 bloody years. But okay, suddenly we've discovered this might be an idea. And he says he's going to facilitate it. But then when he was asked about Bill C-69, which not everybody's familiar with, but that's the anti-pipeline bill. It's a bill that makes it virtually impossible to get a pipeline approved and built. And Carney said outright, no, I'm not going to get rid of C-69. Well, then you're lying. You're outright lying. If you really want to get pipelines to the coast, the first thing you have to say is we're getting rid of that bill. And if you will not get rid of it, he's got no interest in getting more economic development to Western Canada. He's just saying what he feels he has to say to get elected. And I don't expect we're going to see any progress. We'll just see more further shutting in of our resources.
And so, for the listeners who are not familiar, and in fact, I'm not overly familiar with Bill C-69, this is a bill brought in by, I guess, the Trudeau Liberals put this in, and
Yes.
it prevents new pipelines from being built.
Yes, it puts in such onerous regulation. It doesn't help any with that picture.
Yeah, I know. It'll be, I'll see if I can lighten it up in the mix.
The sun's moving over there. We
Yeah.
got somebody else in the boardroom, so coming to
Yeah.
this office. It brings on some crazy heavy regulations, one of which is what kind of killed the Energy East project when they were working towards bringing a pipeline to the east, which would make the oil companies responsible for downstream emissions of the product.
Oh my God.
Now, no private company is going to sign on to a liability like that. It's like telling an ammunition company, you're going to be taken to court if somebody takes one of those bullets later and uses it in a crime. So if we export the oil to another nation and they don't burn it in an area with, I don't know, catalytic converters or something, the oil company is actually going to be on the hook for those emissions. It's ridiculous and it's absurd. And they know exactly what they were doing when they put that in. And that's when TransCanada said, well, we're out of Energy East. We're not signing onto that. We can't do that. So it's a poison pill. We cannot develop reasonably that sort of infrastructure. It goes on to many other industries as well. We've got uranium out here. We've got forestry. We've got agricultural products. But when we have a government that just feels those aren't a priority in helping develop, we just don't, it feels futile.
And Carney has specifically said he wouldn't scrap C-69.
He said outright on that one. Yeah. So.
So you were saying in the book, this is not gonna happen with a single issue party in Alberta. This has to be a grassroots movement, and in your mind, the next step or the what's the word I'm looking for? The catalyst for all this has to be a provincial referendum.
Yes.
Does the Liberals winning help or hinder that cause?
There's no doubt it helps the cause, but this cuts two ways, and I'll kind of explain that in a moment. But if the Liberals are brought back in, it will bring about just such fury and frustration and a sense of futility. Like nothing we do, it seems, no matter how badly abused we are, we can't seem to change this system. So people will say, well, maybe we can get the hell out of the system, and that can lead to the better organization of groups on the ground. As far as the party aspect goes, as I said in the book, it would have to go, what we need is the proper framework and legislation so citizens can initiate that referenda. Alberta's legislation is garbage for that. Premier Kenney brought in a referendum legislation, but he set the bar so impossibly high with a short timeline that we're never going to initiate one in this province. So Premier Smith would have to amend that legislation. I think the first step is people saying, okay, give us that ability, Premier Smith, that we're not playing by the spirit of that legislation by leaving that bar that high. We want to see it amended and brought down. And I suspect there's a number of members of the legislature who would support such a move to amend that legislation. Premier Smith was already asked about independence, and just the other day she said, that's in the hands of Albertans. We're not going to do it as a government, but if they initiated a referendum, that's up to them. So it's a
Interesting.
kind of an implicit way of saying it's a threat. She won't support it, but she's not going to stop it. She's saying it's a democratic right. So the movement would have to get on the ground. It would need some sort of leadership, and that's difficult when you don't have a party. But groups can do such. There's still four parties out there with independence mandates in Alberta, and they rarely can garner more than 100 votes at a time in elections. But there's also a group called the Alberta Prosperity Project, for example, which is an independence-minded activist group, and they've held meetings with hundreds and hundreds of people showing up in town halls all around the province already. That's exactly the sort of movement that could spawn a referendum if the legislation was tuned. So I mean that would certainly be a catalyst and get things rolling fast. The other part I talked about though is if the Conservatives get in, which is very possible still. We'll see. I mean, it's only halfway through the campaign.
I think it's going to happen, but I was going to ask that if they get in, can this be can we kick the can? I mean, I would love the country to hang together is my personal sentiment, but do Albertans, do separatists like you say, no matter what happens, I just want a path to get out of this confederation?
Well, people like myself, I mean, I feel it's the system is too inherently broken for us to pursue any other path. Even if it's going to take longer, we still have to pursue that path. So I talk about the book, is it possibly we just need something to tear down the engine so that we can rebuild it? Maybe Canada still could be a concept, but we need a new contract. We need a new agreement. And nothing less than a province tearing out is going to give the appetite across this country to sign into a new agreement. When it comes to the Conservatives, I mean, it would slow down the more immediate rage. But as I say in the book, it's the long-term frustrated independent supporters like myself, they get created by Conservatives, not Liberals. We expect the Liberals to screw us. It's when the Conservatives screw us that we really become pissed off. It was when Mulroney gave the CF-18 contract to Montreal rather than Winnipeg because he wanted to pander to Quebec. By every other aspect, the bid from Winnipeg was superior, but he needed votes in Quebec, so he gave it to Quebec. Likewise, Poilievre, he will not get rid of supply management. He's made that clear, even though it's a Quebec-based policy that really kind of screws Canadians across the country.
Can I quickly jump in? And can
Sure.
you, is it possible to give viewers the Reader's Digest explanation of what supply management is? Because I'm a Canadian, I hear it every election, I still don't understand it.
Sure, certainly, and it's been a pet issue for me as a libertarian because it drives me bananas because it's such an anti free market policy
Yes.
that I just maddens me that any conservative can claim to support it. So it's a policy that was brought about, I believe, in the 60s. It's to protect the dairy industry. It also applies to poultry and eggs, but it's the dairy is the big piece of it. And what it does is assigns quotas. If it limits and controls the exact amount of production of dairy products and then sets the price for it. So something that showed how stark and how bad it is was a dairy farmer in Ontario actually put out a video showing dumping 40,000 liters of milk down the drain.
Yeah,
And
I
he said,
saw
all
that.
right, because this is how bad this policy is. If he overproduces beyond the quota that he's assigned, it is illegal for him to even give the milk away. He can't give it away. He can't sell it. He has to dump it down the drain. Or my wife actually grew up in a dairy farm. Her father had a quota for cream, but he didn't have a quota for milk. So they would produce from the cows. It was just a small operation, skim the cream, sell that. The family would consume as much milk as possible. The rest was given to the pigs because, otherwise you can't do anything with it. It is an artificial market. Plus, parts of that supply management whole program impose huge tariffs on any incoming dairy products coming from any other country. So it's impossible to compete with Canadian dairy farmers. That's been a sticky point we've seen recently, of course, because I think a lot of the stuff Trump has gone on about has been exaggerated, but he's absolutely right. Our tariffs are ridiculous when it comes to dairy. It's just a bad, bad policy. There's been policy papers written by a former liberal. She wrote one showing the average Canadian family is paying as much as $400 to $800 a year extra on their grocery bill because of these supply managed products. Now, the root of that issue, when you look at the balance of dairy farms across Canada, Alberta has something, 500 of them, I believe, or something like that. Ontario has a few thousand, and Quebec has something close to 6,000 of the dairy farms. It's very Quebec focused. Another irony of it is they said that this supply management system will protect the family farm. When they brought it in, there were 140,000 dairy farms across Canada. Now there's 11,000. What it's done is made it you have to be a large operation to purchase those quotas. The quotas themselves became a commodity. To buy a quota to produce dairy, you have to spend a fortune. So this system is very entrenched. They're a very effective lobby. They lobby the liberals and the conservatives, and being Quebec face focused, every politician is terrified of touching it with a 10-foot pole. During the last leadership race, the conservatives, I had Pierre Poilievre on my show a couple of times, and I asked him because, as I said, it's always been a policy that bothered me. Would you get rid of supply management? And he didn't like being asked because it's just a sticky point for conservatives because no conservative can look at that. It's Soviet style, is what it is. It's price fixing. It's cartels. Look at it and say it's a good idea, but they also know politically it's a hot potato with Quebec. He said, no, we won't get rid of it. He said it'd be too expensive to get out of it. So just kind of to go a little further, New Zealand and Australia used to have the exact same system. They both got out of it. And the way they did it, though, was it's true because the farmers had become so reliant on the system, they own those quotas, they are a commodity. The government had to basically buy out their quotas over time. So it cost of quite a bit to compensate those farmers so they don't bankrupt them, throw them under the bus because they became dependent on a system that the government created in the first place. But in the long run, New Zealand's dairy industry is doing fantastic. They are exporting all over the world. They have blossomed. And
Except to
likewise,
Canada.
yeah, well, they're not allowed to sell here. And they've brought it up. They're pretty upset with Canada's supply management system. We lost a trade agreement with the UK because of our protection over cheese with the supply management system. So, it's just a kind of a side digression, but it does show again how much Canadian politicians will bend over backwards when it comes to protecting an industry in Quebec, but they won't hesitate to throw Alberta under the bus and Saskatchewan and such when it comes to oil, gas, and agricultural products.
Okay. So I took us on a segue there. You're talking about how other policies that the conservatives have stuck to over the years have sort of put more of a floor under the independence movement than the liberals have. Is there anything else?
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, we could point to lots of other individual ones. As I said, it's just that when the conservatives do those sorts of things, as they must if they want to win, that's when the people watching it realize the futility of trying to change things. That's when the ones who are really upset with the liberals, they could potentially flare out. Well, maybe after 2 years, maybe the conservatives will fix that later. But when they realize that the conservatives aren't going to fix it either, that's when you get an independent supporter who's not going to bend from force any longer. So both outcomes of this election, I don't see an end to the growth in independence. It's just the difference in the speed and how committed some of the supporters might be.
Okay. And then the other question I had, well, I want to talk about this whole 51st state business, but before we get to that, the NDPs were the previous provincial government before Danielle Smith. Okay, so
Yes.
that's pretty left wing. How did that fit into the dynamic in that province?
That would set back the independence movement without doubt. One of the things I say in the book too, if you want this movement to be real, if you want to be credible, you have to be able to point at your own government and say, we're going to be better than that one. When you put the NDP in here, as I think I said it in the book, do you want to say Prime Minister Notley? Like, now we're going to have an NDP prime minister who's even worse than a liberal one. That was a consequence of a vote split, though. I mean, the NDP was never popularly elected in Alberta. We'd managed to come up with a magical formula with having the Wild Rose Party, a provincial party, fighting with the Progressive Conservative Party, both of which were on the right side of the spectrum, duking it out, while a personable leader with the NDP managed to slide up there and garner a majority. Thus is the nature of democracy in a first past the post system. But
That
it says
sounds
it back.
familiar.
Yes, it does, doesn't it? That was something we did to ourselves, and it set things back. Absolutely. I mean, how can we have confidence in ourselves to be better if we can't even clean up our own backyard?
Yeah. And so now the big wild card, or it's not even a wild card, it's kind of like a bomb being thrown into the mix, was Donald Trump and his 51st state talk. And it started about patrolling the border. Was it ever really about that? Then it became like an epic troll, the governor of Canada, and now a almost backhanded endorsement of Carney. So where to start here? Would a separate would a Alberta secessionist movement eventually inevitably wind up as the 51st state?
I don't know. That's one of the things
Yes.
hard to say. As a guy who writes, I don't feel the appetite is there. It definitely won't be people leaping straight to the 51st state if it ever happens, which I do kind of think is unlikely. The progression of events, I mean, it's just even looking at Canadian legislation and so on would mean we have to have an independence referendum first. We got to get out of this agreement before we even consider signing into another one. And I don't. There's been a lot of people standing up in Alberta saying, I'd love that. I'd rather join the States. But that's a loud minority, I believe. There was a, I did a speaking tour with the book to a bunch of those Alberta Prosperity Project meetings, actually. And Dr. Dennis Modry was the first speaker. And we, you kind of repeat things as you go. And he would always start out with the room with a straw poll, getting people holding up their hands. What would you like to see? Would you like to see a stronger Alberta within Canada? A few hundred people in the room and a handful of hands would go up. Yes, we just want to stay within Canada, but be stronger. They're saying you want to be completely independent Alberta outside of Canada. The majority, that particular curated room, the majority put their hands up. And he'd said, would you want to become the 51st state? Because it's always hung in there as an option. And again, there was a very small minority of that room. So this is a room of independence-minded people. But even then, it was only a small amount wanted to jump to the States. They were pro-Alberta, not necessarily they love the USA. They're comfortable with it, but it doesn't mean they want to join it necessarily. The other aspect is, despite Trump's trolling and everything else, I don't know if there's that much appetite for the rest of the United States to do that. It's just so much farther down. I mean, independence is already a difficult road and on an almost unlikely path. When you talk 51st state, now you're narrowing that down to a much tinier likelihood. I couldn't see it happening until at least after the provinces exited the formal federation to begin with, and then might be considering a second referendum after that.
Right. And I mean, we're probably talking decades of runway at that point. It's funny because I live here in, well, it's not funny, but so I live in Toronto on the West End, very troubled by what I see going on in this city and in this province. And if it were up to me, we'd have left. Well, maybe not, but my wife is an immigrant from Barbados, and she loves it in con she loves Canada. She doesn't want to go back to Barbados. And she's like, and she doesn't want to move to the States. She's like, I'm not moving to the States. But she said on and off in the past, she would think about Alberta. She said, if you really, if we have to go and you're, Alberta is doable. So it made me think of, we wouldn't do this, but this happened, like everyone fleeing California to Texas because of the high taxes and terrible crime. And then they get to Texas and they start voting in left-wing politicians and sort of re-implementing, starting this process of taking Texas down the same path that they took California down and then fled. I mean, it's very early to even think about this kind of thing, but how do independent-minded Albertans think about, oh, all these Ontarians are going to come in, and what if they do the same thing as the Californians, or will they assimilate, or is that ever an issue? Does that ever come up?
It is, and it's narrow thinking. When independent supporters bring up that sort of thing, they forget the people, the majority of the people who came to Alberta or Saskatchewan, for that matter, or BC, whether from other countries or within our own country. These are people who had the courage to leave their comfort zone, leave their friends and family, take a chance, move to a new area and try to do better. That, for the most part, is not a liberal mindset. A liberal mindset is, I want to stay here. I'm entitled to all this stuff. You've just got to send it to me. And a lot of those people, when they get here and working in the independent circles for a long time, they, especially ones from Eastern Europe and people who come over and they see what's happening, they're horrified. They're some of the most strong independent supporters because they're saying, I went through all that to get here and I'm seeing these assholes pulling the same stunts here. I'm going to fight it with all the fiber of my being. And if we get some, I'll call it intolerant, born Albertans who stand in the room and say, no, we've got to, stop those other ones. Well, for one, you're going to drive some supporters out of your own room right off the bat because they're offended. They came here, they worked their butts off like everybody else, and now you're calling them jerks because they came from another area or considering them a threat to your movement, and they aren't. They are some of the strongest supporters. And I like to remind people, I say it, look, Rachel Notley was born in Alberta. Some of our worst, as far as governors and so on, government type people are born here because they were entitled. They got it lucky. They did all right off the bat. So you do want to worry about an influx of people who can mess up, a movement. But to be too paranoid isn't the right way to go about it. You want to see that as a strength, and it certainly can be. It should be embracing the new Albertans, whether they're coming from other parts of the country or other parts of the world, because they want to preserve this new homeland they've made and make it as strong as possible. And that's the mindset that independence-minded people have to work on because they have screwed that up in the past.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a fair number of first and second generation Eastern Europeans on my team here, and they've seen this movie before, right? Like, Communism is bad. Like, there's no way to sugarcoat it. Why are we going down this same direction as you know, the place where either I fled? I've got a C-level guy who remembers the hyperinflation in Yugoslavia. He's like, yeah, I was a kid, but my mom would come home on Monday night. She got her pay packet and she'd run straight back out and go shopping so that we could get some food before the money evaporated to nothing. And in a lot of ways, we're headed. This is a little outside of our discussion, but it's very much relevant actually, because it could be a catalyst. But I follow Bitcoin, I follow economics, I follow finance, and I've said, especially now with the tariff wars and Carney, and I think even the CPC saying, you know, we will support Canadian workers to whatever extent is necessary, which means money printer go burr in Canada. We have the background conditions for a hyperinflation in Canada. By hyper, I mean like a high inflation. I don't mean wheelbarrows full of money hyperinflation, but maybe like a turkey hyperinflation, like 37, 57% a year, and the Canadian dollar falling to 10 cents US. That could happen.
Absolutely. It was a very life-changing moment for me. I got lucky. I got to tour the Soviet Union back at the end of the 80s before they went communist. And I smoked back then. And I remember buying cigarettes for 25 kopecks a pack, or no, 50 kopecks a pack, which worked out at that time to like 25 cents because it was 2 Canadian dollars to a ruble. And now, I don't know what the heck it is, 1,000 rubles to a dollar or something like that. The ruble is worthless. It's still worthless. Their whole economy had to adapt due to that inflation. It didn't hit the Venezuelan level of hyperinflation or some of those African countries. You know, Zimbabwe, I think, went bananas. But it's bad, and that it can't happen. And socialism is always the driver for that. So I've always got an awareness that just I didn't live it, but I got to see how bad socialism and communism are for an economy and for people in general. And that's part of what I cover in the book too, is people have to understand it's not even necessarily your resources or your location, your proximity. It's the government that makes the wealth ability for people or not. And it's one of my favorite counterpoints when, you know, the first thing people ask about independence movement in Alberta, you'd be landlocked. Well, for one, what's to say we aren't already? And we're not exactly doing well getting across this country as it stands. The other part is if the only determinant of prosperity was access to deep water ports and having oil, Venezuela should be the richest country on the planet. And if being landlocked meant you were going to be poor, how did Switzerland get away with doing how they're doing? Because it's one of the richest countries on the world. In both cases, it's a matter of better governments. Venezuela's socialism destroyed what should have been one of the richest countries in the world. Switzerland's wise, rational, decentralized government has led to them having very few resources, but still being a strong, prosperous, independent nation with no coastal access whatsoever. So we got to focus on the system. That's what I keep repeatedly saying in the book too. Not the people, not the geography, not the resources. It's the system. Canada's system. It's not as bad as Venezuela's, but it sucks.
It's speaking of Venezuelans, there's some Venezuelan Canadian Bitcoiners who, well, actually they're no longer Venezuelan Canadians because they fled. They relocated their entire business to the Cayman Islands. And so, and I wrote an article about this saying when the Venezuelan expats are fleeing the country, you got to take notice. And they're like, we've seen this movie before. And we're not sticking around for a repeat.
And that's what I was saying. I want to see them stay, then people stay and build this to stop the incoming socialism rather than flee, because then we've really lost an ally.
That's another thing, another reason, another point my wife makes to me when I say I want to get the hell out of here. She's like, well, if it's really that important and that big, shouldn't we stay and do what we can? Like, shouldn't we fight, not run? And as our spouses often are, they're wiser than we are. And so it's like, okay, a point taken. I mean, the tragedy of it all is Canada. We're not Switzerland in the fact that as a country we're not landlocked and we're not resource depleted. Like, we have it all, right? We should be an energy and technology superpower of the 21st century. We absolutely could be. But we have this ideological, globalist, collectivist ethos from a minority of the people that is really sabotaging the whole thing. And then you could even get caught up in this hole. You could go down a rabbit hole. Is it intentional or is it just incompetence? And I always err on the incompetence side.
And I think it usually is. I think one of the aspects of this, though, I mean, it'd be hard to convince people in other parts of the country, even some here in Alberta, but I believe that if a Western province or any province could break out and shatter this agreement, it could be better for all of Canada in the longer game. As you said, we've got it all here. I mean, we've got a relatively peaceful nation, loads of resources, highly educated, healthy. We should be one of the, I mean, when you compare us to Africa, we see people who go to the lowest common denominator. Well, you're way better than Rwanda. Okay, but I don't want to measure against the bottom. I want to measure against the top. And if we could redraft this system, if we could decentralize this government, we can recognize our strengths in a new system and properly utilize them. As I said, we've been trying to fill holes in demand through poorly planned mass immigration. We paid a terrible price for it. Shortcomings in housing and healthcare resources, all sorts of things. I mean, we do need to have immigration to keep prospering. We know that, but it has to be planned immigration. Plus, we should be starting by balancing our population in the country first. If you've got mass unemployment in Newfoundland, Nova Scotia, Cape Breton, and in a worker shortage in British Columbia and Alberta, why are we bringing somebody from North Africa to fill the shortage out here? Let's start first by trying to encourage people to migrate across the country first and balance it. So we aren't paying a bunch of social services into an area that doesn't have the resources to sustain it, and then pouring people in who have a large adaptation challenge into an area that has a labor shortage immediately. Like, we aren't using our own resources effectively within the country. And it's not an anti-immigrant view. We still need people from all over the world to come in, and we should. And it's nice that we can welcome them, but we've got the resources here first. But instead, we're artificially trying to keep it by giving more and more equalization to those outlying provinces and draining from the productive. I mean, socialism again, 101, and it's harming us. If we redrafted the agreement, this country could be far, far better from coast to coast. But it's got to start, I think, with an independence movement.
When I was, I might be dating myself here, but like in when I was a student in the late 80s in college, I had this idea that Ontario should separate. This was during the Quebec referendum, and it was like Ontario should separate, like, screw the rest of the country. I lived in a bubble and I didn't really understand very much, but I think, and then later, when I realized that Toronto is like 22% of Canada's GDP is in Toronto, I was like, Toronto should be an independent city state, right? And I like registered sovereign.to because I'm a domain guy, and I thought, and then I realized like Toronto is way too left wing for that as it stands now. But I think the unifying theme to all this is that, I was listening to you talk about Quebec and how we have all these bad policies to keep Quebec, placated. Is that I found myself thinking maybe Quebec should separate. It would take a lot of that odd dynamics out of the equation, and the rest of the country could rebalance. But when I think that through, where I keep winding up is just the rest of the country has to fire Ottawa. Like, we have to eliminate the federal government basically, and just redraft that agreement, as you say, and maybe something like Alberta succeeding in a referendum would redraw that map.
Yeah, or Quebec succeeding might redraw it too.
Yeah.
We're both of the same age. We kind of lived through Beech Lake and Charlottetown.
Yeah.
Those were strong efforts to change the Canadian Constitution. I don't think they even went far enough, but they're relatively modest compared to what I think needs to happen. But they tried to go through the process, which is a difficult process. Actually, it's an impossible process. That's what it demonstrated. We can't change our constitution within this country. There's not enough will. You need too many provinces all to sign on with the larger majority of the country. There's no substantial changes ever going to happen to the Canadian Constitution as it stands. So then that means we got to tear it open. And the only way I can see to do so is for a province having left. Once a province has left, the federation is over. The agreement is done. Like we've got, it doesn't, nullify what's left for the other nine provinces, but we're suddenly going to see a heck of a lot of motivation to maybe redraft something on the part of all Canadians.
That's the
So,
catalyst.
yeah. And as I've said in the book, I've said that the public speaking things, whether, the day after independence, what does that mean? Does that mean a new agreement or negotiation with Canada? Does that mean these provinces stay as 10 independent units? Does it mean, I don't know, the world's our oyster. I think there's room to rebuild Canada after that. There's a very respected late columnist and publisher in Alberta named Ted Byfield. And he used to call it refederation.
I
And
like that word.
that was his vision of it too, was, we just, again, we, it doesn't mean Canada's done, but this is just going to be the process to get in and refederate this thing, pull it back together. But we're just not going to be able to try and do it piecemeal or through the constitutional formula that we have, because it's just unworkable. And I find in having that discussion with people, when you can get that long-term discussion, it helps soothe, because it's the feelings, and feelings are real. Sentiment is real, and attachment to the concept of the nation is real. Well, again, that's why I keep focusing on the system. If you can look at it that way, then you can still value Canada. You just understand that it's being poorly served by the document that's holding it together right now. And you can still love Canada and hold it together. You just got to change the deal.
That's probably a good concluding thought right there. How do people follow you, and what else can they do to follow the Alberta separatist movement?
Sure. Well, with me, I'm pretty easy to find. I mean, if you Google Cory Morgan, I'm pretty prolific. I write for the Western Standard and Epoch Times. I have a regular show on the Cowboy Network and a few other channels. As well, if you really want to get see me unfiltered, yeah, go on X and at Cory B. Morgan. Finding the book, of course, Sovereignty's Handbook on Amazon, and at the audiobook version, of course, out there. And people really like that these days, listen to it on the drive and whatnot. So just do a search, you'll find it. And as for the independence movement in general, yeah, just keep looking. There's Alberta Prosperity Project. There's a number of parties promoting that sort of thing. And I suspect, as I think, perhaps you do, and a lot of others, we're going to see a lot of movements suddenly spring up like daisies if the Liberals get back in. And it's just be a matter of whether it's sustainable or not. Well, time will tell.
On one hand, I can sort of, if I was an Alberta separatist, I would want the Liberals to win from an accelerationist point of view. And in here in the Bitcoin circles, there's a sort of like a subcult of Bitcoiners called accelerationists that want socialist collectivists to win to sort of hasten the demise of the economic system. I am not an accelerationist. I just sort of watch the world accelerating and try to navigate it as best I can. So I would like to see, as I said, the band stay together. I'd like to see sanity return to Canadian politics within the system as we have it, and try and fix things. But it's really not up to you or to me. It's up to I guess the wider population, and we'll see what happens on the 28th.
We certainly will. It's going to be interesting, if nothing else.
I call it a national IQ test, and we're going to have to find out if we pass or fail. But Cory Morgan, thanks for coming on Bomb Thrower TV, and let's catch up again after on the other side of all this.
Yeah, you bet. I'm sure there'll be lots to talk about, no matter what the outcome is.
Okay, take care.
Thanks.